Hello and welcome to Talking Aussie Books, a new weekly podcast shining a spotlight on Australian fiction. My name is Claudine Tennellis. As a writer and avid reader, I love chatting about books. And in this podcast, I'll chat to authors, publishers and readers, giving you, dear listener, insight into what's hot on the Australian fiction scene. So if you're looking for your next book recommendation or just want to know more about Aussie fiction writers, this podcast is for you. Grab yourself a cuppa, sit back and enjoy. It seems trite to say that my next guest is one of Australia's best loved authors, but I don't know how else to describe the juggernaut that is Jackie French. She has written over 200 books across a variety of genres, from children's picture books to chapter books for middle grade readers, young adult novels and adult fiction, along with a swag of non-fiction titles. Jackie's writing and services to Australian literature and literacy have earned her over 60 book awards, and in 2016, Jackie's work was recognised with the award of Member of the Order of Australia. She was Australian Children's Laureate for 2014 to 2015 and Australian Senior of the Year in 2015. Born in Sydney, Jackie was raised on the outskirts of Brisbane, but for the last 40 years has lived in the Araluen Valley in the southern tablelands of New South Wales. Late last year and early this year, when Australia was ravaged by devastating bushfires, Jackie almost lost her family home. Much of the land around the property was burnt before a flood reached them, making their property the main source of food and water for hundreds of animals, such as wombats, quolls, possums, owls and wallabies, to name a few. Inspired by the survival of one wombat who walked out of the fires on charcoaled feet onto her property, weak with thirst and hunger, Jackie penned her latest children's picture book. The book is called The Fire Wombat, a brilliant story of survival which was beautifully illustrated by Danny Snell, and I'm honoured to be chatting with Jackie about this book on the podcast today. Welcome, Jackie.
Thank you. Hi.
I guess it's fair to say that you're most well known for your children's and young adult books, so I was wondering if you might share with listeners why you were drawn to write stories for children in the first place.
I never was. It's purely and absolutely accidental. I've been writing books since I was six. I was told, no, dear, you could never make a living as a writer. To say I was strongly discouraged from wasting time writing is an understatement, apart from teachers. Teachers encouraged me, but family, first husband, etc., no, I wrote in secret. I sent my first manuscript off simply because I desperately needed the money to register my car, and could think of no other way of doing it as a single parent living in a shed in the bush with a baby. But that book, Rainstones, had a young protagonist. She's about 12, 13, 14. She believes the drought may end if she can find an Indigenous person with rainstones. But the only Indigenous person she knows is the local building inspector who grew up in Redfern. I didn't know it was a children's book. I don't think I write children's books. I write books. Some books, like the forthcoming Angel of Waterloo, have got the themes that are probably too strong for young people. Not that if they pick up the book and they read it, it'll do them harm. On the contrary, I think probably they simply wouldn't want to persist with it. Other books like Diary of a Wombat, I have a feeling most sales are probably to adults. Well, in fact, of course, all sales are to adults because they've got the money. But in fact, for adults. I've got a lovely Diary of a Wombat story. Years ago, I had a lovely story, a letter from a man in France who said he had gone into a bookshop one night and had found the French version of Diary of a Wombat, and he was laughing at it. And the bookshop owner came over and she said, "Oh, you must buy that book. It is my most favourite book." And he said, "I will buy the book if you will come to dinner with me." So they went out to dinner and the evening progressed. And every night they would sit by the fire and they would read Diary of a Wombat together. And she called him her big French wombat. And after 3 months, he said, "It is a good thing that wombats are imaginary. I could never, ever live up to them." And she said, no, wombats are real. This is based on a real wombat that lives under the author's house. And so he wrote to me and he said he was going to propose with a ring in the copy of Diary of a Wombat over dinner. And would I please write an inscription in the copy saying, "Will you please marry this man, for he will love you all his life." And so I did, and they got married. and I still get a Christmas card. It's almost as though write one book about a wombat, and that is what you are known for all your life. At least half my books are for adults. But I will always be known as the author of Diary of a Wombat. I will be known for wombats. And yes, okay, wombats do play a very large part in my life, but almost accidentally. Until I came here about 48 years ago, I'd never met a wombat. I had no interest in wombats. Yes, they make you smile when they walk past, but I was living in a tent, then a shed, and I would have breakfast on the ridge every morning, and a wombat used to eat there as well, graze there, and he got curious. Day by day, he just came closer and closer, and he decided he wanted to be friends. It was his decision, not mine. I never touched him. I never fed him. He led me to extraordinary places in the bush. He made it obvious he wanted to show me things. And it was one of the strangest and deepest friendships I have ever had. A friendship with a wild animal who simply decided he wanted to be friends with a human. Now, that wasn't the case with Mothball in Diary of a Wombat. She'd been raised by humans, and that is how she knew that carrots were good, and it was up to humans to provide them. I don't have that relationship with wombats now. I live in a house, and the wombats mostly stay outside. We go to a lot of trouble to try and keep them outside. But yes, it was quite accidental that I wrote for kids, and it was the publishers who assumed that because it was a young protagonist, it was a book for young people. It was shortlisted for the New South Wales Premier's Award, the CBCC Book of the Year. And I kept on writing books that had young protagonists. And I still will. Even some of my books that are very definitely for adults start when someone is young. But I don't see myself as a children's writer. Apart from a couple of books that were written as stories to amuse very young children or to distract very young children, all of the books I write, I just write books. And my style doesn't vary whether it's for adults or for kids. The worst thing you can do for kids is write down for them, or for that matter, change the language you use. That is how kids learn vocabulary. That's how they learn the concepts of the world and how to be human. Kids. In fact, I think are more interested in deep themes and beautiful language than adults. Often as adults, we're mostly concerned about paying a mortgage or, actually getting the kids bathed and the teeth brushed and getting them to bed on time. The job of a child is to understand the world, to understand language. They've got an incredibly clear idea of right and wrong. And they are often the deepest and most profound audience to write for, which of course means that books that can be classified as kids' books, of course, are for adults as well. And there are very few books, in fact, apart from the books for kids learning to read. At that stage, you often get very short, funny books that are easy to read. That will be very popular and will sell very well. But the picture books that sell very well, the books for older readers, older younger readers, like young adults, that sell very well, those are books that adults love just as much as kids, or they would not be bought. No parent or grandparent, or very few, will buy a picture book that they are not prepared to read at least 50 times and possibly 10 times in a night.
I absolutely love your passion, particularly when it comes to children's literacy. Now, Jackie, I understand from reading a bit about you that you are dyslexic and you're open about the fact that you're dyslexic. And obviously, this hasn't hindered your writing or your desire to write, given the number of books that you've published, obviously. But do you think that being dyslexic has contributed to your desire to write?
Not really. I knew I wanted to be a writer when I was about three. My first 4 years were spent being looked after by my great-grandmother, who was not a teacher because married women were not allowed to be teachers, but she was married to a teacher teaching kids to read and write. So by the time I was three, I could read and I knew I wanted to be a writer, but I didn't know I was dyslexic. The word dyslexia wasn't used when I was a kid. I knew that I couldn't read the words on the board, even though I could speed read a book. I knew it was almost impossible for me to form letters. But I had the most wonderful teacher for the first 2 years at school who accepted the fact I could speed read Black Beauty, but not read Run, Jack, Run on the board. And I still remember the hours she would spend guiding my hand with copper plate, for showing me actually how to form letters. She never made me feel I was stupid. Dyslexia runs very strongly in families. When I was six, my mother said, look, don't worry if you can't write legibly. When you leave school, you will have a secretary and they will write for you. That's what happened back then. I only really discovered that Dad couldn't write legibly when he retired and no longer had a shorthand typist to do all his work. My grandfather, who was, first of all, a neurosurgeon and a psychiatrist, would always had a vision of him, of the nurse saying, no, doctor, the other side is the right to operate on the brain tumour. But he always just laughed and said that, of course, the reason he went into medicine, because everyone knows that a doctor's handwriting is illegible, so no one would ever notice the fact that he couldn't write legibly or spell. It was just something that was taken for granted, but also extraordinary luck. When I met my English teacher many, many years later, she told me the story of reading my first essay, and it was so illegible, she put it to one side, assuming it was just a failure. Then she felt guilty, and she read it, and she loved it, and she called her husband and said, look, you must read this essay. He took it away and came back 20 minutes later saying, what language is she writing in? Oh. I had no idea my writing and my spelling was so bad. When I met my high school history teacher, again, many years later, it was at a literary festival. And his voice, he ended up as a professor of history. And his voice boomed out over the audience, Miss French, wonderful to see you again. Of all the students I have ever, ever had, you are the most incredibly. Look, I was waiting for him to say, look, brilliant historian, insightful intelligence, etc. The most illegible writing I have ever come across in my entire career. He never, ever, ever let me know in all of that time, none of my teachers did, that my work was so illegible. Whether it's been a help or not, I don't know.
I think when you're dyslexic, you've got two choices. You can either give up or you can focus and be very, very, very determined. I think that's possibly one reason why just about every person in medium security prison is illiterate. They cannot read or write. They are dyslexic. It's this absolutely great untouched social problem we've got. As one bloke in prison said to me, look, you can't even get a job stacking shelves if you can't read and write. What other choices did I have? Possibly more choices than armed robbery, but he has a point. So, yes, a lot of people with learning difficulties, with dyslexia, end up actually giving up. Their sense of self-worth is just so low. But yes, they go into crime. Their lives are not good. Or you can have a lot of luck, as I did, with the most magnificent teachers. You can also be determined. And that's another reason why so many successful people are dyslexic as well. Dyslexia isn't a superpower, but it gives you a superpower. It does mean that if you are going to survive as a dyslexic, you need to learn to focus. And that really is the difference between doing something well and brilliantly. It's the power to focus, to concentrate, to not give up, to be very, very determined. And that's the one thing I can promise dyslexic kids, or two things. I can promise that these days there are techniques that can teach everyone to read. They may not find the right person and the right program at first. There's a lot of snake oil out there and an enormous amount of ignorance about how to help kids who are dyslexic. But I can promise there are people there who can help them. And I can also promise that if they keep working at it, one day they will soar because they have learned how to focus and be determined.
Jackie, I was interested to read that you're an ecologist and obviously have a passion for wildlife, since many of your picture books, as we've already indicated, are dedicated to them. You're a passionate gardener and have authored many articles and books on gardening. But as we already mentioned, there's a fair number of your books, including this latest one, that are dedicated to wombats. So I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit more about that. Why wombats?
As I said earlier, it was entirely accidental. I'd never met a wombat before. And so, look, I think I'd just simply go back to that one story. A wombat decided to be my friend. And that was the beginning of, well, so far 48 years of friendship and fascination with wombats. But also, back then, no one except a 14-year-old boy, P.J. Nicholson was 14 when he did it. He was somewhat older then, and he's somewhat older now, as we are co-directors of the Wombat Foundation. He was the only one who'd actually done any detailed study of wombats. A friend and I put together some skeletons of wombats. We wondered if wombats had arthritic changes in their bones. So we collected skeletons, we put them together to actually see what we could tell by the skeletons. We rang the National Museum to find out if we'd done it properly. And they got terribly excited. Oh, no one's ever done that before. Can we have it, please? There was just no material on wombats. No one had actually studied them. Now, that was back in the 1970s. Now, of course, a lot of people are studying wombats, native animals. We are finally learning about their physiology and their ecology. But there is still so much that we don't know. We're not even sure how long wombats live. It's very easy in zoos to actually get one wombat confused with another and think they might live longer than they have lived. We've really been studying them for a very, very short time. That's one of the things we do in the Wombat Foundation. We raise money and we allocate money for research into the preservation of the northern hairy-nosed wombat. But that research, of course, has enormous implication for southern hairy-noses and bare-nosed wombats. There is just so much we don't know, even about the effects of the things they eat on their health.
Now, Jackie, in my introduction, I spoke of the bushfires of last summer and the wombat that inspired this story. So I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit more about your experiences during the bushfire and why you decided to write this book.
It's very hard, actually, to remember the bushfires. The only thing I actually remember about Christmas Day is a phone call to my brother. It was just one day like every other day, watching the fires, watching the wind, watching the weather maps, doing ember patrols, etc. But we evacuated four times. The bushfire for us began with one from the northwest. It seemed to be a long way away. It seemed small. But suddenly I went into Canberra, in fact, to do a book launch. And I was just standing up to speak when my husband rang to say we'd been told to evacuate. The fire was nearby. All he could see was smoke. He was going to drive down to a neighbour's place, which would be more easily defended than ours. And then literally, just as I was standing up to speak, the neighbour rang and said she'd expected him an hour before. And she couldn't see anything up this end of the valley except for smoke. And he wasn't answering his phone, etc. And I stood up to speak, I think in just actually rage and anguish, assuming I'd lost my home and my husband. Anguish and anger at the politicians who had ignored the advice for years, and particularly the previous year, of experts saying this year will be catastrophe. We have to do this, 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 and this. And instead of doing anything, they actually cut funds. They cut equipment. In the year when catastrophe was predicted by every expert, we all knew it was going to be horrendous. And they not only did nothing, they took what we had away, and I was angry. After that, four evacuations, coming back when we could, keeping an eye on the wind so that if the wind changed, we would leave very quickly. But a lot of the time, the roads were closed anyway, so there was no way that we could leave, nor was there any safe place to evacuate to. At one stage, the town was surrounded by flames, and most of the time, the roads around here were shut because of fires and because of burnt trees, etc. They were closed, the bridges had been burnt. So evacuation at several points was impossible. But one night in January, at that stage, Brian and I were sharing Ember Watch. I'd stay up to about 2 or 3 a.m. looking for embers, putting out any embers that fell, feeding the animals, making sure that there was water still coming through. And then he would get up around about 5 a.m. and he would take over from me. In those nights, the sky was just red. You didn't need a torch. In fact, torches were no use because torches can't see through smoke. Visibility was about 5 or 6 at the most, 10 meters. But it wasn't dark. It was red. It was red during the day. It was red at night. There wasn't much difference between day and night. And this little wombat stumbled out of the smoke. She was clearly starving, exhausted, and she just collapsed. She couldn't quite make it to the water. I took a dish of water to her and I held it under her nose, and she very slowly, over about a period of 2 hours, drank some water. And then finally she struggled to her feet and stumbled over to the food and water station. At that stage, there were hundreds of animals there. There were wombats, there were wallabies, there were quolls, there were powerful owls, snakes, echidnas, possums. I've never seen anything like it. All of those animals stood back to let this little animal get to the water. Even Wild Whiskers, who is the nastiest, grumpiest wombat I have ever met, and who will bite any wallaby who dares to come within 10 metres and who lurks behind a bush so she can bite me as I come up the stairs. She is a truly nasty, grumpy wombat. Even Wild Whiskers stood back to let this little wombat eat and drink. The animals had animals do have truces when things are bad. Animals that usually eat each other don't eat each other. They don't compete. They just stand side by side by the water drinking. In the wombat holes, there were so many different animals. The little fire wombat was too weak to walk very far for the first 2 days. She just sheltered in the shade of the house. Then on the third night, or the third day, she went down and shared Phil's wombat burrow. Phil is actually a very, very nice wombat, but all of the wombats were sharing their burrows then with wallabies and echidnas and bettongs and bandicoots and a whole range of other animals were sharing the wombat holes, including snakes. And as soon as it would get cool again, she would come out and eat and drink. And those nights, Twitter was really my company. People on the other side of the world, in California, in Iceland, in Italy, in France, were awake. And I was raising money for the local bushfire brigade, for books for kids in fire-stricken areas through the Children's Book Council of Australia, and also for a wildlife organisation. And I auctioned anything that was legal. I will do anything that is legal. You just nominate it, which means that the next 8 books I write are going to have wombats in it because people wanted naming rights for wombats, also dedications. It's amazing where you can fit a wombat in a book, even a book about actually making a movie in 1932 in Sydney. I managed to put a wombat in it. It's amazing where you can put wombats. Just that second night when I knew she was going to survive, she came from fire country. Her fur was smoked to black, too weak to get to water. The others all stood back. They waited as we fed her and no one tried to bite. This is her second evening. We think she'll be all right. And the response was enormous. People across the world asking, how can we help? Look, it was the worst of times. It was the best of times. I will never, ever forget the help in those days. And that too is what I've put into the fire wombat all across the Smoky Nation. There'd been a vast carrot migration everywhere. People raised money. They sent food. They built water stations. People took leave to look after injured animals, to crochet bags for injured animals. Every time the roads were open, people we didn't know would be driving utes or trucks and just unloaded bags of loosened pellets, of hay, of carrots, of pears, of celery, of apples, of sweet potatoes, carrots. The possums thought they were in paradise. They'd never had a buffet like it, fresh corn cobs. There's no way we could have fed that number of animals without all of that help. And I don't even know their names. Just whenever the roads were open, they turned up with animal food. And then the last week, the fire was on the ridge to the south of us, and the wind was coming from the north, bringing floods. And so we waited for a week. If the wind had changed, the house and all of this end of the valley would have gone very quickly, but it didn't change. The wind stayed strongly from the north for a week, and the flood reached us before the fire did. And it was a magnificent flood. It washed all of the fire debris from the creek. It washed all of the debris from our roof so we could connect our tanks again. It washed the debris from the land and the embers. It put out the fire. It was just this glorious crashing black roaring water, just crashing its way and smashing the few bridges that were left after the fire too, and also collapsing our road. The road above us, the public road, is in fact no longer a road. It is a sheer mountain. So the road skid away. There are a lot of roads which are now no longer roads in this area. And anyway, it rained and it kept raining, and it's been raining a couple of times a week ever since. The grass has grown. It is just so green around me, and the cattle are looking so bored with grass, and so are the kangaroos. And the animals, in about 10 days, 2 weeks, all left the food station and presumably went back to the areas where green leaves and grass were growing again. And that included the fire wombat. I thought I would never see her again. The rain had washed off the smoke from her fur, and she was a brown wombat, not a black wombat, with a particular grin. Every wombat has got their own grin. Wild Whiskers' grin is a particularly malicious one. But about a month ago now, I was driving down the valley, and there she was, the fire wombat. And she had a baby next to her. I thought she might have had a baby in her pouch in January, but I wasn't sure, because wombats, if they've had several baby wombats, their pouch can be a little bit extended anyway. Yes, there it was, this round, furry, plump, happy, bouncing baby, and it is charcoal black, just like the bushfire. And she just gave me her sort of wombat grin as to say, oh, hello, we have met, haven't we? And went back to eating. And the baby went back to bouncing and eating as baby wombats do. And I wish I could have put that chapter as the final one in the book. But during the fires, after I'd written that poem on social media, I just very quickly wrote The Fire Wombat. It's about how animals survive fires underground, the defensive strategies they've got. Echidnas, for example, their top quills will protect them. They actually burrow down. Goannas will burrow into termite mounds. Kangaroos will smell it. Cockatoos send out scouts to find safe places from the fire. If cockatoos are around you, you know that place is safe, at least for a while, until the cockatoos fly away again. So it was about that. It was about, well, that fast carrot migration, how people across Australia, across the world, came together to help in a catastrophe. And it was about, it's a story of hope, of humans and animals working together to get through catastrophe and how things regenerate afterwards.
Just going back to what you said earlier and the work that you did in this time, you did a great deal of work to raise funds yourself to save our wildlife. And in fact, I was going to just mention and highlight a portion of the proceeds from the sale of this book are going to go to the Wombat Protection Society. Is that right?
Yes. Yes.
And so can you tell me a little bit more about this organisation, or indeed any others that are doing this kind of work?
I'm the patron of the Wombat Protection Society, which means, in fact, I don't do any work. My days of looking after injured and baby wombats are over, both physically and the desire not to get up every 2 hours to actually feed babies. They're a society that, yes, looks after injured animals, looks after orphaned animals, but also does an enormous amount of research, particularly into mange. There seems to be a new kind of mange, a more vicious mange, which is devastating wombats. Look, again, we don't know. Wombats have gone through bushfire, we've gone through drought, etc. We've gone explosion of feral animals. We simply don't know. But the Wombat Protection Society does an enormous amount of work in basically curing wombats and working out ways of curing wombats who have got mange. And I've seen the most dramatic rescues. wombats that just have lost half their fur, their skin is just scabbed and bleeding and they are blind. And 3 months later, you wouldn't know they had ever had mange. So wombats are not officially endangered yet, but we're heading that way. And it's organisations like the Wombat Protection Society who are making sure that we will always have wombats.
So, Jackie, you've written a number of historical novels. How do you decide what areas of history to write about? Is it purely interest?
I don't choose what area of history. I just suddenly become absolutely fascinated. I read absolutely everything I can. And then years later, I realise that the themes I've been thinking about, that is where I'm going to write. But also too, I get caught up in the things that have been hidden in our history, particularly the history of women, Indigenous people. We were there, we women, and yet so much of history is about dead white men in cities. And it shouldn't be that way. There were kids there, there were women there, there were people of so many nationalities and cultures. And I find things that we have really forgotten. One, for example, was the abdication, that wonderful 1936, to be with the woman I love speech, etc., etc., that has been so romanticized. And actually finding out that he didn't mean to abdicate. They tricked him. What he thought was that if he abdicated, his brother would also abdicate. He would be made King Regent, which would mean he could marry Wallis Simpson. He would be King Regent for Elizabeth, who after all was only a girl, so he'd be king for forever. He thought he would be king again by evening. He didn't write that speech about renouncing the throne to be with the woman I love. He wrote another speech calling on the people of Britain to rise up and make him king again and rebel. And it was the Prime Minister who wrote that speech and convinced him that he'd look like an absolute idiot if he admitted that he'd abdicated by accident. He didn't even bother to read the abdication papers, which of course is why he later found out he'd signed away his rights to so much property and income and his right to live in Britain. He had no idea. He was a fascist and an idiot. And it's finding out things like that where history has, well, you can see why that was covered up. The really fascinating thing is even when those documents are released, people are still perpetuating that lovely romantic story of the young king who gives up his throne for the woman he loves instead of a fascist twit who did it all by accident and then called on the people to rebel to make him king again. So it's things like that. The latest book, The Angel of Waterloo, is about a young female surgeon on the field of Waterloo. Women were not supposed to be at battlefields, but of course they were. They were there as surgeons. They were there simply giving aid to the wounded or even giving mortars to the wounded. They were also there loading firearms. Wives would often accompany their husbands. If their husbands were very good shots, they would have several firearms, and the women would actually do the loading of the shot, passing it to the men. The women were there, but they have been written out of history. So often that's where I do get the ideas for my books. It's where I come across somewhere where we have completely misinterpreted history. Important things have been changed in history, and the myth is perpetuated.
That is absolutely fascinating. I had no idea about that story about Edward.
I think it's the fourth of the Miss Lily books, Lily's Lies and Love. Wow. And you will find the very true story of the abdication in that book.
That is incredible. They certainly didn't put that on the crown, did they?
No. Well, I haven't watched it. But
it's definitely, that wasn't the version of history that
series. It's not the romantic one, is it? It's not the history we want to believe. And also so much of the history is the history that the men or the people in power actually want us to believe. Yeah. The untold stories of the women in World War One. The only stories we hear are of these brave nurses. There were only a few official nurses there. But instead, women did most of the transportation, the feeding. Most of the hospitals were run by women, and they weren't official ones. Part of the reason they have been left out is embarrassment, but the fact that the military was so incredibly unprepared and incompetent. But also, too, most of it was unofficial. And so when you are writing an official war history, Guy Bean, who, by the way, I've got enormous admiration for, he was asked to write an official history. So he wrote about the official units. But most of the feeding, the transport and the medical care, if you go back through the individual records of the men, you actually find that it was all unofficial.
not official.
I could talk to you about this for hours. Given the areas where your interest lies, how much research would you typically do for one of your books?
Probably about 10 or 20 or 30 years.
No.
As I said, I don't actually research a book. I get fascinated. I find every bit of material I possibly can. Whether it's Google archaeological surveys or whether it's letters or diaries or books written at the time so I can get the feel of the way people spoke and their emotions back then. It really varies with the book, but it's a passion for the subject. And it will be years later that I realise, aha, there is a story nibbling at the back of my neck. It is finally actually pinged together. And this is the book I have to write. And it won't stop nibbling until I've actually written the book. But if I have to do much research, I know I don't know enough to write the book. If you don't know what people had for breakfast, if you don't know if they had pockets in their clothes, if you don't know these everyday details, you don't know enough to write a historical novel. Write an alternate history instead, and then it doesn't matter if you get it wrong. The research I do will be things like, was it a Tuesday or was it a Sunday? Because if it was a Sunday, of course, there'd be certain things they'd be doing that they wouldn't be doing on a Tuesday. What was the weather like? Yes, if you're writing about a battle or a coronation or even a birth, it really does matter whether there was a thunderstorm or a flood or a heat wave on that day. But apart from those detailed things, I don't do any research for the books.
You've worked with a number of incredibly talented illustrators for your books, and I was interested to understand, do you choose the illustrator or is this something that's done by your publisher?
That's done by Lisa Berryman of HarperCollins, who I am just so blessed to work with in partnership. She's the one who works out what style is going to work for which book. I just do the words. I have an image in my mind, and every time, of course, that image vanishes. Once I've done the words, the book no longer belongs to me. It belongs to the team at HarperCollins and the illustrator as much as to me. I'm just a member of the team. But I do, of course, have veto or even choice. It's very, very rare that Lisa will suggest an illustrator and I'll say no. In fact, I can't remember that happening. I can remember her suggesting them, half a dozen, and we look at them and we both actually say no, doesn't work, or this one works. But I can never, ever think of a time when Lisa was wrong. In fact, life is much easier if you just assume that Lisa is always right. life is much easier if you assume that your editor is always right.
I love that. Given your impressive output, listeners might be interested to know whether you write one book at a time or work simultaneously. How many books would you work on at any one time?
Only one. I'm only ever writing one book at a time, mm-hmm. but there will also be, I will be getting page proofs to correct and things like that, so and revisions to do. So I'll stop writing that book and go back to a previous book to do revisions or page proofs. But the actual creating of a book and writing a book, only one book at a time. You can only really carry two universes in your head at once, one you're writing about and one you're living in.
So, Jackie, what does your writing day look like?
Probably it depends whether the shrike thrush has been tapping at my window at 5 a.m. as it did this morning, which means it started very early. It's very boring. I will get up, I will do an emergency check of emails because quite a few emails will come in overnight from overseas. Do the usual things, have breakfast, etc. Answer the urgent emails, then probably answer the non-urgent email and then start writing. I'll break to actually have a walk or put the water on the vegetable garden or pick something for lunch or for dinner or take a break to do some cooking, answering mails, talking to friends. By and large, it's a very, very boring routine of the same thing every day. Talking with my husband after dinner, often doing a little bit more work after he's gone to bed because then I can often have an hour or two when there are no emails coming in. And I get a free chance just to actually write without interruption. But look, all of the time there are things happening. There will be a wallaby bounding outside, deciding to eat the roses. There'll be a wombat at the front door. There'll be the shrike thrush at the window. There may be a fire across the ridge, or there might be a flood coming. When you live in the bush, there are always things happening. In the city, all there are human things. In the bush, every day is different. Every day there are different things blooming. Every day, you never know what you're going to find has actually grown up or fruited or flowered in the next time since you've been there. Every day is the most extraordinary adventure and extraordinarily beautiful. Even in the drought, You see the bones of the land, and they are lovely, even in the fire. Looking back now, after the horror, I can actually look back and realize it was beautiful. That red sky, the red air, the white and the grey smoke against that totally, absolutely blue sky as the fire started. It was horror, it was tragic, but it also had the most extraordinary beauty too.
Looking at your website in preparation for this interview, I noticed that it was such a treasure trove of information, not only about you and your life, but your interests, your books. But I also noticed that you had a section for writers, which listeners can obviously review at their leisure later. But for the benefit of the many writers out there who listen to this podcast, Jackie, I was wondering if you could offer a few of your top tips for those who are wanting to write a novel or seek publication for something that they're working on.
First of all, make it about something that people want to read about and need to read about. There are a lot of mediocre books around. You can't write a good book unless you have got a gripping idea and concept to begin with. And that's actually the most important thing, the thinking rather than the writing. We've all read books that were so clumsily written we kept on cringing on every page, but the story was so gripping we had to actually keep going and keep going and keep going to actually find out what was going to happen, even though the writing was appalling. Now, it's better if you can have superb writing and a superb concept, but if you've got to choose, have a fantastic story to tell. And you will keep the reader with you. Write the ending first. You can't write an ending without knowing where your book is going. Every book is a journey. So write that last paragraph first. And if it doesn't move you, you really need to keep thinking about your story. Now, you won't stick to that ending because, of course, as you write, the book will change. But if you write that ending, you'll know the journey that your book is going to have, and it will make it so much easier to write it. And the most important one is don't overwrite. Most of us are in love with words. We adore words, and so we use too many of them. No one ever turns a page thinking, oh, isn't that a lovely image? I'm going to turn the page and get another image. Images and description are like salt. A little bit of salt accentuates the food and makes it delicious. Too much salt and you only taste salt. And it's the same with an image. An image must be original, it must be poignant, but it also must be unobtrusive. Once it starts to obtrude, once you have too much of it, all you taste is the salt. You lose the sense of pace in your book.
Yeah, fantastic advice. I love that. Thank you so very much. So, Jackie, you must be working on something else. Can you tell us about that?
The next book is the Angel of Waterloo, and that will come out in a fortnight, come to think of it. That is about Hen, not Henrietta, a young female surgeon working with her father on the field of Waterloo. She was born on a battlefield. She will be married on a battlefield. She will be widowed on a battlefield, possibly. And she will come to Australia hoping to find the husband she lost and also a land where she will be free to practice medicine, to actually live a life of challenge that's not possible in England for a woman of that time. And she will discover that her closest friends will become the Indigenous women, who are also surgeons and medical experts, the exchange of knowledge. Now, I know it's important that the massacres, the traumas of the past must be acknowledged, but going by the stories of my families, by other families, we also need to acknowledge that at some times and in some places, there was enormous friendship and respect and exchange of expertise between the colonial women and the Indigenous women. The story of my great-great-grandmother who survived falling into a river on her honeymoon because she'd been taught to swim by the Indigenous women at a time when most colonials simply did not swim at all. Now, it didn't last. I have to emphasise this was at some times and at some places. But those stories need to be told too. And so this is one of those. It is a story of friendship and mutual respect. It's a love story. It's also a story of how the Napoleonic Wars created Australia's colonial policy. Most of the administrators were men who'd either fought at Waterloo or in the Napoleonic Wars of the Peninsula. And they came with a conquer mentality. You take the land, you fight and you take the land. How could they possibly understand a culture where every war had to stop at dusk so that you didn't have collateral damage to the land and to people who are not involved in it? It was complete and utter incomprehension. So it's about, yes, the shadow of Waterloo on Australia's present, but also too, it is a glimpse of what was this incredibly deep friendship and learning from each other. And I hope it may be a glimpse of Australia's future too, what we can be.
Jackie, I wanted to say it's been an honour and a pleasure to chat with you about the Fire Wombat and some of your other works. Thank you so very much for joining me on Talking Aussie Books.
Thank you. And possibly this is where we might mention that our interview has been interrupted by failing satellite Wi-Fi, a drive down the valley, and my escaping from a funnel web spider all in the middle of the interview. So it's been quite an interview, and thank you so much for persisting.
Well, that's a wrap, folks. If you enjoyed this podcast, please leave a review on iTunes or drop me a line via my Instagram at Claudine Tennellis or on my webpage claudinetennellis.com. Thanks for listening. Until next time, happy reading.